Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Thursday the 16th of September 2021, and this is Reconstruction with me, David Taylor, from the Construction Index magazine, and Phil Bishop, editor of our daily online news service. Good morning, Phil.
Morning, David. How are things?
Very well, thank you. Yes, very well indeed. Still nice and sunny here in Devon.
As it is here. Have you been anywhere interesting lately? Actually, I know the answer to that question already. I've read the latest issue of the magazine. I see you've been to Wells Cathedral.
I have, yes.
That must have been a lovely day out. What did you see there?
It was, actually, yes. Well, that was a little while ago. But yes, it was a lovely day out, actually. Really nice weather and a beautiful place. I'd never been to Wells before. For those who don't know Wells, it's a cathedral city in Somerset. Actually, it's the UK's smallest city, which is quite handy for pub quizzes, I guess. Yeah, Wells Cathedral is a wonderful building, obviously. It's a 12th century Grade 1 listed cathedral, generally considered presumably
all cathedrals are Grade 1 listed, aren't they, I would imagine?
I think so. Actually, there's a whole issue about the listing of ecclesiastical buildings, which I'm not 100% up on at the moment.
Anyway, I interrupted, I apologise.
Yeah, that's all right. Well, we could talk about listed churches some other time. But anyway, that Wells Cathedral, supposed to be the best example of early English Gothic, 12th century cathedral, it's got this magnificent west front, which is obviously showing the ravages of time. And there's a company called Clifton Conservation, which actually based at the at Clifton House, the stately home in Berkshire. Conservation contractors, specialists, they've just completed a pilot project to restore this very ornate stonework on the west front. They've only done the top part of the gable, actually, because the idea is that they're sort of paving the way for a full restoration of the entire west front. And I went along there expecting to see them, you know, stonemasons carving new statues and all the rest of it. But it's nothing like that. In actual fact, there's very little new stonework involved. It's the idea is rather like antiques restoration or art restoration. The idea isn't to try and restore to pristine newness this stonework. It's to actually try and arrest the deterioration. So you look at some of these badly eroded statues, you know, they're sort of, you know, 700-year-old statues. And some of them are really badly eroded. They've got no facial features. They've got no fingers, this kind of thing. They're not trying to restore them. They're just trying to arrest the deterioration. And that in itself is fascinating because they're using very subtle techniques. It's quite scientific. They have to develop mortar mixes using lime and different sands and aggregates to actually fill in gaps, fill in holes, and also to profile parts of these statues. And the finished product, you can't tell where the mortar ends and the stonework starts. It's really, really clever. So that was a fascinating job and, you know, a very different sort of site visit to the sort I'm normally used to doing. One of the interesting things about it was, you know, looking at the role of conservators, you know, historic buildings conservators within the construction industry, because of course there is a massive overlap. They are part of the construction industry, but they operate in a completely different way. And I found one of the interesting topics we discussed. I met the senior conservator there called Berenice Humphreys, who obviously is managing the project. And she said one of the difficulties is actually recruiting, training people for that type of work because, you know, you need a CSCS card to get on most sites. And there's no CSCS card for a conservator because the range of skills involved are very broad. You know, a carpenter or a stonemason, they can get their NVQ and then their CSCS card, and then they're marketable, basically. But sometimes a Conservative cannot get on a site because they haven't got an NVQ and they haven't got their CSCS card.
How accessible is it as a career to someone who maybe has been spent a few years doing, you know, fairly dull brickwork and thinks this sounds much more interesting? Is it transferable, or do you need to be have a bit more of a sort of an arty, sculptory, pottery sort of background?
Most conservators, I mean, Berenice is a conservator, and in fact, the other two conservatives, both female and both graduates of Lincoln University, they tend to be university educated. So there's a lot of, there's a lot of chemistry and science involved. There's quite a lot of artistic training involved. It's a very sort of wide ranging qualification. So, I mean, if you were, you can enroll on a university course. And in fact, Lincoln University, which is where the two conservators I met had studied, is one of the few universities now that actually does offer a bachelor's degree course in historic building conservation, although other universities are doing it as well. So you tend to come from that route rather than up through the trades. But that's not to say that there aren't transferable skills, because, of course, a lot of the work actually on site is very physical work. You're actually, you know, working with materials, you're assessing the job site. It's a hands-on job, but there's a lot more to it than that. So I think it's a fascinating career. I don't know whether or not there's a shortage of conservators. That's something I didn't ask Berenice. But I do know that it is quite difficult sometimes to qualify.
And are they using old-fashioned traditional materials on this job, or are there modern materials with lots of chemicals in that can do things better and quicker and easier?
Well, that's something else which is addressed in the article, actually, because I mention in the feature the lime cycle and the use of lime in building. And of course, it's something which I suppose over the last 20 years or so has become a little bit more high profile. But back in the 60s and 70s, there was an academic, Professor Robert Baker, I believe his name was, who actually looked at some of the restoration which had been done using sort of modern cementitious materials over the sort of, you know, course of the 20th century, which had actually done more harm than good. And he looked back at the traditional methods and materials used, and he developed something called the lime method of restoration. And that is using basically natural lime mortars and lime wash and materials like that. And this is what is used now universally through the sector. There are some fairly high-tech techniques used, although they weren't used here. There's something called nanolime, which is, if you get the limes, particularly limestone, tends to erode and becomes very porous, lets more water in, and of course it accelerates the deterioration. Nanolime is basically calcium hydroxide in suspension, in an alcoholic suspension, and you sort of paint that onto the substrate, and it soaks in a bit like that, you know, that wet rot wood hardener stuff you can buy from B&Q, you know,
it soaks into
sort of spongy wood, and it sort of reinforces it. And what this does, the alcohol evaporates and deposits the calcium hydroxide inside the limestone matrix, and which is one modern technique which is used. Another one is to actually just drench the substrate with lime water, which is literally just a very, very thin water solution of lime. And the problem with that is that all the water can sort of mobilise salts and stuff like that and actually make the problem worse. But yeah, it's basically lime, and it's mixed with carefully chosen aggregates and sands to match the substrates. It's applied with a trowel or with a brush. Then it's followed up with something called a shelter coat, which is like a thick lime wash, which is also pigmented to match the stonework itself. And that's a sacrificial coating. It goes on top of the repair. You rub it with a bit of Hessian to sort of make it bond with the substrate. And then that's what erodes subsequently. The actual stonework underneath is protected. Obviously, you need to go back and replace the shelter coat at some later date, you know, several years later. But Yeah, it's fascinating. Another thing which they're tackling, which is very common apparently in old limestone masonry, is sulfation. And that's it's a result of burning fossil fuels, basically. You get this, the gases which are in the atmosphere react with the limestone, and they create calcium sulfate, which is a hard film that forms on the outside of the stone. And that can actually hide the deterioration below the surface, which continues unseen, basically. So they have to clean that out. And sometimes they even, because it becomes hollow, you get these blisters forming on top of the stonework. And they actually use syringes to inject a lime-based mortar underneath the blisters to protect the stone, which is something I'd never come across before. So, yeah, fascinating job. They finished in August, actually, right at the end of August. And obviously they're waiting to see now what the results are. The main purpose, I suppose, of this project as a pilot was to test different materials, test different techniques, and also the way the project was managed, the way it was documented and recorded as well. So if this is deemed to be a success, then a contract will go out sometime in the next couple of years, I believe, for the wholesale restoration of the entire west front of the cathedral.
That'll be a big job, won't it?
I think so, yeah. And I mean, when I went there, there was an awful lot of scaffolding up against the front of that building, and there's going to be an awful lot more when this contract finally gets underway. But yeah, fascinating job.
Well, should we move on from the 12th century to the 21st century?
Might as well.
September 2021. Latest news. I just want to mention briefly, we talked about the demise of Cleveland Bridge a few weeks ago. We said it was going to administration, yes. And we rather hoped and I think expected that someone would come along and save it, but that's not happened. So an update on Cleveland Bridge. The administrators have, despite discussions with potential white knights, they came to nothing, and they're preparing to close the business following completion of final production on the 24th of September. So that is sad, and there have been some accusations flying around about, or allegations, I should say, of mismanagement of the business, and it should never have happened, and it shouldn't have come to that. So I think there's perhaps a tale to be told there at some stage, but it just seems slightly sad, and should, you know, bow our heads for at least 5 seconds in memory of Cleveland Bridge.
And that's a sad story.
And talking of disappearing names, we may also, but I doubt it, have heard the last of Robert Jenrick. He's a young man, I'm sure he'll come back. But until yesterday, he was the Secretary of State for Housing, Communities and Local Government. But he's got sacked from the Cabinet and the Cabinet reshuffle. He was the youngest cabinet minister. I don't know. I can't remember how old he is, but I'm not even sure he's 40.
Was
yet.
He? I didn't know that. Okay.
He's certainly outrageously young in government terms. Yeah. And he'd been in the job.
He made himself quite unpopular, though, didn't he? With his planning reforms.
Well, the planning reforms were certainly controversial. It was said that they lost the was it Amersham, the election or somewhere around there.
Yes.
The by election went Liberal Democrat over planning proposals. But other people, you know, some people seem to rate him. The local government association wished him well and said he'd stood up for the cause of local government in his 2 years in office. But we've got a much bigger name taking his job. Michael Gove is deemed as a demotion. He was the cabinet office man, Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, which is one of these odd jobs which means whatever they want it to mean, it seems.
Yeah.
I don't see it as a demon. I mean, coming from our perspective, housing, construction and so on, I don't think it's a demotion at all. It's a huge job that Michael Gove's been given. Let's hope it's up to it. He's deemed as, I mean, he's, some people say he's one of the brightest brains in Parliament, and others say he's a devious little...
He might be both, of course.
But people say the same about the Prime Minister, so...
I mean, he has sort of emerged, hasn't he, as a really central figure in in the cabinet, especially since the departure of Dominic Cummings. I think we've seen a bit more of Michael Gove.
Cummings is Michael Gove's man, of course. It was yes. Gove that brought Cummings into the scene, because when he was Education Secretary, he had Cummings as part of his team of yes. advisors. No, Gove has got a lot on his plate, big challenge, and it'll be interesting to see how he gets on. Personally, I don't think he will be there long enough to see anything through. They're already talking about another general election on the horizon. And we're used to these ministers coming and going in short order. To that extent, Janet was there quite a long time, but not long enough yeah. to sort out the planning bill, which is still going through and seems to be falling apart. But there's an awful lot of uncertainty, it seems to me, that in government with regard to what the construction industry's got on its yes. plate. I mean, we have this. They published the pipeline of projects, of big infrastructure projects, which is meant to help the construction industry plan its workload and so on. But there seems to be, despite this, as much uncertainty around big projects as ever, whether it's short-term ones like Stonehenge Tunnel and Lower Thames Crossing, they're supposed to be starting construction in not too far away. I mean, we haven't been told I don't think the main contractor for the Stonehenge Tunnel has been named yet, but the shortlist is there. And despite the courts having said it's not legal and thrown it out, the procurement process is still going on, but we don't know whether that's going to go ahead or not. Lower Thames Crossing is subject to challenges. We don't quite know what's happening there, another big project. And the latest thing, which may or may not happen, is the Leeds leg of HS2. A lot of reports saying that that's already been, work's already been stopped on that, planning work. HS2 London to Birmingham appears to be going perfectly well. A year into construction, while lots of people still want that to be scrapped, I don't see that happening, but I think the Leeds leg is certainly in jeopardy.
I was really quite surprised to read about that. I mean, I think, you know, that I'm not a great fan of HS2, but I think that if they were not to go through, you know, take it through to the full extent that they had planned, I think that would be a huge betrayal, actually, not just of the construction industry, but of the nation itself. I mean, this is a huge infrastructure project. It's extremely controversial, and I think the least they can do, if they're going to despoil, you know, hundreds of square miles of the British countryside, they could at least see it through and deliver a finished product project at the end. So, I don't know. I think in a way, it's like a typical government betrayal of its election promises.
More than that, to me, the London Birmingham leg, I can't remember exactly how long it currently takes to get from Birmingham to London by train, how much it saves, but there's not that much of a saving with HS2 between Birmingham and London. You can get from Birmingham to London reasonably okay at the moment, and HS2 will make it better, more capacity, and so on and so forth. But HS2 will reduce the journey time between Leeds and London, all being well, from 133 minutes to 81 minutes.
Yeah, that's significant.
That does seem significant. All the talk about, we're only saving a few minutes, what's the point? Well, that's more than a few minutes, 133 minutes to 81.
And it makes me wonder, you know, we talk about levelling up, we talk about improving. What's the phrase about improving things up north?
It's the levelling up, is that what they're talking about.
It's the levelling up, yeah. I mean, this is what the government's supposed to be all about, I thought. And yet they'll say, well, we'll do London to Birmingham and then, you know, we'll just sort of draw a veil. I think that would be a betrayal.
The bottom line is we've got no money. We're more in debt than ever. Revenues have dried up. There's no money. And you either, you know, shut down bits of HS2, or you shut down hospitals, or you shut down schools, or something's got to give. Yes, taxes are going up, we know that, but that's not enough. I mean, there are big issues that we've faced. We continue to face this whole COVID thing, and there will be consequences. We know that. Yeah. We know that. And it seems the least surprising news of all was the Financial Times reporting that Boris Johnson's pipe dream of a fixed link between the mainland and Northern Ireland, whether it's Scotland, Northern Ireland or Wales, I think it's mainly going to be Scotland was the landing point that was being looked at most. That's dead in the water, basically, at least for now.
Or under the water anyway. And I think that definitely deserved the chop. I mean, it was a ridiculous idea.
But, well, it had only been the subject of sort of desk studies, but still, I think lots of, you know, consultants make quite a tidy packet studying things which are never going to happen, don't they? So, but the going back to the HS2 Leeds thing, one thing that struck me was, we posted something on this earlier this week, a whole bunch of business leaders, 63 of them, under the auspices of the High Speed Rail Group and the Railway Industry Association, wrote a letter to the Prime Minister saying, don't scrap Leeds. It's a really bad idea. Now, the problem is the thrust of their argument was saying, you can't scrap this because loads of jobs depend on it. It's going to be, you know, there's going to be lots of jobs involved in this. And this is people's lives we're talking about. And there's some validity in that, but I think they should at least, it's a bit like saying we need to dig lots of holes and fill them in again because that would create jobs. I mean, the justification for building HS2 cannot be that it creates jobs. And that could be a spin-off benefit and a justification for maybe doing that instead of something else. We know that construction is a great economic stimulus and we need economic stimuli at the moment. But let's dig holes and fill them in again argument doesn't really wash.
But I think that has been the preoccupation of the entire construction industry ever since HS2 was first mooted. I mean, they never saw it in terms of improving infrastructure for the nation. It's simply been a job creation scheme for the construction industry, and that's one of the reasons why I'm not convinced by a lot of the arguments in favour of it.
It does sound awfully a lot of vested interest. You look at the people who signed this letter. The bosses of these companies signed this letter saying, "Ooh, we must go ahead, take HS2 to Leeds because we need the jobs." Mace, Volca Vessels, Kelkbay, Barhale, Van El, Acom, Ramble, WSP, Waterman, Jacobs, Tony G, RSK. What have they all got in common? They're going to make money out of this project.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
So it undermines their argument. They may be right, but they're the wrong people to be saying it, I think.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, I suppose, you know, they can't just sit on their hands and say nothing because, I mean, it is important for them. But I think it does expose their attitude, you know, where they're coming from, in other words.
That said, I'm with them. I'd just rather someone a bit more independent had been.
You'd be able to go and see your mother more quickly, wouldn't you, Phil? Doesn't she live up there?
Well, that's the plan. But sadly, even if the Leeds legs does go ahead, my mother would be well into her second century by the time this is finished.
Oh right, okay, fine. Well, that's enough of the news for now, Phil, because we've got a guest joining us now. And our guest today is the theatre director, Nicholas Kent, former artistic director at the Tricycle Theatre in London. He was there for 28 years at the Tricycle. And while he was there, Nicholas, often in partnership with journalist and playwright Richard Norton Taylor, pioneered what became known as the Tribunal Play. And these are plays constructed from verbatim accounts of public inquiries and have included titles such as Srebrenica, Guantanamo, Bloody Sunday, and perhaps most famously, The Colour of Justice, which was based on the McPherson inquiry into the murder of Stephen Lawrence. And if you're wondering why we're interviewing a theatre director, well, here's a hint, because his latest production is entitled Grenfell, Value Engineering, Scenes from the Inquiry. Welcome, Nicholas. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Not at all. My first question, I'm not familiar with all of your productions. I have seen most of The Colour of Justice. My question about the Grenfell play is, phase one of the inquiry is now completed. It's been widely reported. And as with all these tribunal plays, what does a theatrical dramatisation add? What does it contribute to the debate?
I think it makes a great addition to the debate, because I think what happens with these inquiries is they take place over a very long period of time, as you well know. Part one, we're hardly dealing with at all, phase one. But phase two has now been going on since January 2020 and is likely to conclude probably in the middle of next year. And we're doing modules one, two, and a little bit of module three, which is dealing with the people who did the refurbishment, the contractors and the building control and all sorts of people who did the refurbishment in part one, module one, and then in the second module, dealing with the material manufacturers, Arconic and Celotex primarily, and then in the third module, dealing with the relationship with the tenants. Mm. Now, all of that is the hearings of 6 or 7 hours a day over 4 days a week, every week for months. And although the public can read about it in the newspapers, it's really difficult to follow it concisely and get an overview of where the whole inquiry is going, who is to blame for the terrible cock-ups that caused the fire from the refurbishment and all of that. So you get a very concise overview in 2 hours on stage, and you can follow the narrative, really, of what went wrong.
Because it is important to stress, isn't it, that you're not rewriting this. This, the dialogue is all taken verbatim from the inquiry, isn't it?
Yes, every single word spoken on stage came from the inquiry. Mm. And we've tried to make it concise, make it very understandable for people, and to tell the story of what happened with this very botched refurbishment.
It's interesting that the title is Grenfell Value Engineering, because of course both Phil and I will know that value engineering is a phrase which has been used increasingly over the last couple of decades in construction, and it's widely considered to be a virtuous activity. The idea is that you get a specification for a building project, and then you look for savings. You look for savings, ideally, which don't compromise the design or the performance of the building. But value engineering is often used, I think, and I imagine at Grenfell this is possibly the case, as a smokescreen for basically just slashing costs.
That's what it was. It was the TMO wanted to get the budget way down, and they cut the costs without looking at the implications for safety, fire, all sorts of things. The important thing to them was to bring the building within budget. That was the most important thing for them.
You say TMO was that the local authorities? Procurement.
The Tenant Management Organisation Kensington Borough Council.
Yes.
Nicholas, can I ask, without wishing to prejudge the outcome of the inquiry, you've obviously got deep into what has happened so far, and in a sense, we've become, over the past 2 or 3 years since the fire and things that have emerged, maybe nothing surprises us anymore, but what for you are the most surprising, shocking, striking aspects of what we've heard so far?
I think it's been very shocking to me. I think one of the most shocking things is the way building control has been pared down during the years of austerity and obviously didn't do their job looking at this building. They didn't have enough time. They weren't resourced properly. The second thing is that the architectural firm Studio E seems to have not had enough knowledge about safety requirements, and that hasn't been uppermost in their minds. The TMO were just very anxious to bring the whole building within budget and didn't take the care they should have taken. They didn't consult the residents enough. That's been totally shocking. The residents seem to have been cut out of the picture altogether and treated as pawns in all of this.
And the play, Grenfell Value Engineering, Scenes from the Inquiry, I just want to clarify, does this just cover the first part of phase two of the inquiry, or does it incorporate the whole of phase one as well?
No, it covers mainly phase two of the inquiry.
Okay.
We do recap with the beginning of phase one. We don't take any evidence from residents. We take it from the fire service and the fire control room, and also we take it from the a couple of experts on Barbara Lane from OVARUP on building construction and the principles of fire safety, and Luke Bisbee gives some evidence as on fire safety, and we include those two pieces of evidence in the beginning of the play.
Right.
But three quarters of the play is dealing with the manufacturers and dealing with the regulations that this cladding, you know, very flammable cladding was allowed to be put onto the building, and no thorough checks were made.
Why did you choose to focus on that element of, you know, the phase two part of the inquiry rather than get stuck into phase one, which have also generated some interesting outcomes?
Well, I think phase one is obviously very dramatic, but very, very moving. And I think people who saw the fire, it seems to intrude on people's grief, which we didn't want to do. We didn't want to go over all the personal terrible tragedies that had happened. What we wanted to do was call to account the people who made this, allowed this to happen, had botched the refurbishment so badly. So we wanted to do a piece that learnt from the lessons of the fire and hopefully took forward building of social housing in a much safer and a much more consultative way with tenants, and look to the regulations of all of that.
And why not wait until the conclusion of phase two? Why tackle the first three parts of it now?
Because I think the last parts are very dry. They're about the relationship between government, regulations, local authorities, things like that, which are quite difficult to put on stage. And it seemed to us that people were losing interest in the inquiry, which is a shame, because the pressure needs to be, there's still the enormous cladding issues that people around the country are suffering. So it seemed a very good moment to do it now, to keep the pressure on for the government to do something about remediation, for building regulations to be tightened, and for the public to be able to campaign on those issues.
Right.
In your production, do you think any of the witnesses will garner any sympathy amongst the audience?
I think certainly some of them in the first part, some will, obviously, yes, absolutely. But in the second part, I think it's very difficult to be sympathetic to people who didn't seem to do their job as well as they should have done.
Have you cast Leslie Thomas QC yet?
Yes, we haven't cast him yet. It's out on offer, and I heard today, sadly, one actor can't do it, won't be able to do it. So we've still got it out on offer. But actually, he starts a little later than everyone else because he doesn't interact with other people. He just has one monologue to speak. Mm.
Are you looking for a big name?
No, we're not looking for a big name. We're looking for a very good actor to do it, because it's a very powerful
script. That's the right priority.
And they're not mutually exclusive.
Yeah, no, not mutually exclusive. But we're looking for someone. I mean, it's a very important speech, and a very extraordinary speech, I think.
Tell us a little bit about it. I mean, I know what you're talking about. Not all listeners might. What's that speech about?
Well, he makes a speech saying how this has happened in the richest borough in Europe, and in the poorest section of that borough, 83% of the people who got killed in the fire were from ethnic minority groups and were people of colour, mainly people of colour. And that this is a terrible, terrible tragedy that would not have been allowed to happen in the south of the borough, the richer portion of the borough. It's a very crusading speech and a completely correct one about social justice.
And hand in hand with the production, there's also an outreach programme. Is that something you're organising, or is a third party organising that? Tell us about that.
We're paying for it because it's part of the funding that I'm trying to gather all the time. I haven't quite funded the whole thing. We're nearly there. A lot of some very well-known people have given money, and the Hamlin Foundation and the Joseph Rowntree Foundation Trust have also given us money towards it. But
not Arconic, then.
That's not Arconic.
That would be.
And not Celotex.
That would be a stretch.
We've got working in association with the Playground Theatre, which is in the shadow of Grenfell. It's just about 200 metres away from the tower. And they are in collaboration with us. We have devised a programme called Valued, which will be working with 10 schools and youth clubs in the area, and working with children about justice, citizenship, and the social implications of the fire.
Wow. And obviously it's not going to be produced at the Tricycle Theatre, because you left there about 5 or 6 years ago, I believe. So it's running at the Tabernacle Theatre in Notting Hill, is that correct?
Yes, it's the nearest venue we could find. Okay. It's had a sizable auditorium. It seats 270 seats, and it's about half a mile away from Grenfell. Okay. And we're offering tickets to anyone who lives in the direct Grenfell area through the playground at £5. And £2 if you're on concessions. So we're trying to make it as accessible as possible. It's a not-for-profit production. We hope it'll cover its costs, but we're doing it because we think it will make a huge impact on the debate about remediation of the cladding that people live in, but more importantly, about fire safety and how this must never happen again.
Quite we perhaps right. should give a plug. You may have mentioned him, forgive me if you have, but repeat again, Richard Norton Taylor is the a journalist, Guardian former security editor, who's the man who's done the job of editing down the hours and hours and days of testimony. Yes. Down to, what's the running time of the play?
It'll last, with the interval, about 2 hours, 40 minutes.
Right, so he's edited down to, I guess, 2 hours 10, 2 hours 20 of
yes.
of dialogue, which is
out of
quite
two,
an undertaking.
Quite almost 2 years, yes. Yeah. It is a huge undertaking.
Yeah.
Absolutely huge.
When do you open?
We open on the 13th of October and run to the 13th of November. Mm-hmm. I think people will find it very dramatic and very interesting. It's much less dry than it sounds.
And it goes to Birmingham afterwards, I gather.
It does. It goes for a week to the Birmingham Rep.
That's 16th to the 20th of November.
Yes, you've got all your dates absolutely right. You've done your due diligence.
What about, I'm afraid I'm one of these people who relies on TV for my drama rather than the theatre most of the time. It sounds like something we might see on television before too long. Any conversations?
Yeah, the BBC are having a conversation with us. I don't know whether it'll go anywhere, but they rang us and then they read the script and they were enormously impressed, and we had a long Zoom, and we're now waiting to hear back from them.
Excellent.
Fingers Good. Crossed. Well, I will certainly, if I can find myself in the environs of Notting Hill in October, I'll come along and have a look at that.
Can I tell you how you book tickets?
It's yes, please.
Yeah, it's www.grenfellvalueengineering.com. And that way takes you to our website and straight on to booking.
GrenfellValueEngineering.com.
That's right. It. Thank you very much.
Excellent.
Grenfell Value Engineering, all one word.
Stuff.
Yes.
Nicholas Kent, thank you very much indeed for joining us. And best of luck with it.
Thank you. For
thank you very much.
It. Thank you.
Thanks.
Talking to me. Bye.
Bye.
Well, I'm going to try and get along to that as well, that play, and I'll report back If I manage to get there. But that was a mixed bag today, wasn't it? We covered some ground.
Yeah, certainly did.
I have no idea what we'll be talking about next week, but we'll find something. But for another week, that's all we've got time for. But thank you, everyone, for listening. So from David and I, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.